Hi, this is Jillian, and you are listening to episode 10 of the Court Junkie podcast. I'd like to take a minute to thank all of you for listening to this show and supporting it in all the ways that you do. Subscribing, sharing, leaving reviews, visiting our sponsors' websites, donating. This podcast absolutely would not exist without you. So thank you so very much. If you like the show, please subscribe and leave me a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever it is that you're listening from. Leaving reviews is a great way to support your favorite podcasts. Now on to today's episode. I want you to imagine something for me. I want you to imagine that you're at home, asleep in your bed. Maybe you're dreaming about that special someone in your life, or maybe you're dreaming about something that you love, like puppies and kittens. All of a sudden, you wake up to heavy smoke filling the room. Your house is on fire. You start to panic because you know that your three-year-old son is in the opposite end of the house, and you fear you will never get to him. And sure enough, the flames are moving too quickly. You have to get out. You successfully make it outside, and you barely notice the bruises and the minor injuries that were inflicted on you as you escaped the house. Your neighbors are outside, and you try breaking through your son's window, but the flames make it impossible. You're hysterical. The fire department shows up, their sirens blaring through the early morning air. You frantically tell them that you have a three-year-old son inside, and one of the firefighters rushes inside while all you can do is stand there and wait. After what seems like forever, you see the firefighter emerge from the house with your little boy in his arms, but something doesn't look right. Your son isn't moving. He doesn't make it. And you stand there, helpless on your lawn, nowhere to go, and nothing you can do. The paramedics take you to the hospital for some minor injuries. But you've lost everything. You've lost your house, your only child, everything. But little do you know at that moment that your nightmare is far from over, because you're about to become the main suspect in your child's death. This is Christine Bunch's story. Today's episode begins in June 1995 in Decatur County, Indiana, a small rural area in southeast Indiana with a population of about 25,000, with about half of those people living in a town called Greensburg. Greensburg's website notes that it's more than a city. It's a community where family values are strong and where neighborliness is king. And located in Greensburg is the Crestwood Mobile Home Resort in Lake McCoy, a trailer park community where 21-year-old Christine Bunch lived with her three-year-old son. Christine was a single mom at the time, working and going to school, just trying to make ends meet for her and her son. In the early morning hours on June 30th, 1995, just like how you were imagining that scenario in your head, Christine was abruptly awoken by a fire that was quickly engulfing her manufactured home. She attempted to get to her three-year-old son, Tony, who was sleeping near the south end of their home, opposite to where Christine was. But the fire was moving too quickly, and the flames were too hot. In a panic, she managed to escape, and when she got outside, she and a neighbor tried breaking the windows to Tony's room. But when the windows broke, the flames grew even higher, making it impossible for them to get in. When firefighters arrived, they found Christine standing outside the home with several neighbors. The south end of the home was engulfed in flames, about 20 to 30 feet high. One firefighter ran inside to try and rescue Tony. He grabbed him from the bedroom, but it was too late. Tony was pronounced dead at the scene. Christine suffered mild burn injuries and was taken to a nearby hospital. Her hair was singed, her skin was cut up, and she had blisters on her nose. Investigators met with her at the hospital and interviewed her, but much to Christine's surprise, they told her that the fire was no accident.
Probably only an hour, hour and a half after the fire, while I was in the hospital, that they came in and told me that it was an arson, that somebody had went through and doused the place with gasoline or something. And they wanted to know what family members or friends I had problems with.
That's Christine. I spoke with her for this episode, and she told me that she was shocked when police told her that somebody had intentionally started the fire. She said that while she was at the hospital, investigators continued grilling her about who she knew that may have wanted to harm her and her son. Then later that night, after she was released from the hospital, investigators requested another meeting with her. So she went to the Decatur County Sheriff's Office, and it soon became apparent that the police no longer viewed her as a victim. When did you first realize that you were becoming a suspect in this?
I think the night of the fire, I had left the hospital because I just couldn't take it. You know, people looking at you and staring at you with that pitying expression, and they don't know what to say. And so you feel like you have to say something to make them less uncomfortable. And there's no words to describe that loss, that pain. And there's nothing anybody can say that's going to penetrate. And the people that try oftentimes just make it worse. So I left the hospital, and the sheriff asked that I come to the station at 11 o'clock at night. So I went in there, and I was wearing borrowed clothes and barefoot because I still hadn't went and gotten shoes or anything. I'd virtually lost everything. And so I went in there, and I went into an interrogation room, and there were three officers in there yelling at me and asking me about insurance and what my motive was. And they found it a little hard to believe. I mean, I was 21 years old. I didn't even have car insurance, let alone life insurance or home insurance. I was lucky I had insurance to take my kid to the doctor.
Christine said she hadn't been expecting to walk into that interrogation room and be questioned like that. She left the station after adamantly denying that she had anything to do with the fire, and 5 days later, she requested a polygraph test. During the polygraph, Christine was asked if she started the fire, to which she responded, no. But a few minutes later, the polygrapher told her that he didn't believe her, and he asked why she set the fire. Christine responded that she didn't know and didn't remember doing it. A statement that Christine says was taken out of context. Christine was arrested and charged with arson and murder. About 4 months later, in October 1995, Christine was released on $50,000 bond while awaiting her trial. Christine nor her family could afford hiring an attorney, so they went with a public defender, a man named Frank Hamilton, who had never taken on a murder case before. Prior to trial, the prosecution made Christine an offer. They would drop the murder charge if she agreed to plead guilty to the arson charge, and she would in turn get a 15-year prison sentence.
My decision was easy. I didn't do anything wrong. I was innocent. I didn't start a fire. And I believed they'd gotten it wrong. So I felt that when I went to trial, the truth was going to win out and people would see that.
As the trial neared, Christine got another surprise. She found out that she had gotten pregnant while out on bail. She would have to sit through her murder trial while 5 months pregnant. Christine's trial began on February 26, 1996, with Judge John Westhafer presiding. The prosecutor, William O. Smith, said in his opening remarks that although they hadn't discovered a motive for the murder, a murder conviction didn't require one. He said the state's theory was that Christine intentionally started fires in both the living room and Tony's bedroom, and then she trapped Tony in the bedroom by blocking the doorway with a piece of furniture. He said that along with the investigations by the police and fire marshal, Christine's own inconsistent statements would prove her guilt. The defense argued that the investigation had been done in haste and that accidental causes for the fire hadn't been properly looked into. They said that Christine didn't have any kind of motive and that she was innocent of the charges. The prosecution called Brian Frank, Assistant Chief Investigator for the Indiana State Fire Marshal's Office, to the stand. Frank said that there were burn patterns in the shape of the letter V on four horizontal surfaces, which indicated areas of combustion. He said that a V pattern points you back down to the area where the fire started. He said that a hole was burned through the floor near the bed in the south bedroom, the room where Tony had been. He said it was unusual for a fire to burn in a downward manner and that something has to draw the fire down, something like a liquid accelerant. He told the court that based on his training, experience, and observations at the scene, he concluded that there were two separate fires. The first one was in the south bedroom, where Tony had been, along the south wall, which was caused by the liquid accelerant. The second fire started at the doorway of the south bedroom and then went into the living room. And he said that there was a liquid accelerant poured across the floor of the living room that went to the front door. Frank also testified that a hydrocarbon sniffer, which is basically a tool that detects gas, and a canine, both indicated the presence of hydrocarbons at the scene, and that samples were taken of those areas. William Kennard of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF, corroborated Frank's testimony. He testified that he received 10 of those samples taken from the scene. He tested them for evidence of an accelerant and said he found evidence of a heavy petroleum distillate, such as diesel fuel or kerosene, in the flooring samples taken from the living room and from that south bedroom. So, pretty damning so far, right? Christine said that the ATF report was the one thing that stood out the most to her at trial, the thing that proved to her, even, that the fire had been an arson.
I think the thing that I remember most was the ATF report that said that there had been some kind of an accelerant found in my son's bedroom. So, in my mind, that solidified that it was an arson, and I just racked my brain trying to figure out who would do that, and who I could trust, and who I could believe in, and who was telling me the truth, and who wasn't. It was torturous.
The forensic pathologist who performed Tony's autopsy also testified. He said that he could conclude with reasonable medical certainty that Tony had died from smoke inhalation. He said Tony's blood had a carbon monoxide saturation reading of 80%, which he said meant that it likely happened over a period of minutes. And the firefighter who had run into the mobile home to save Tony also took the stand to recount what happened. Ron Clark said that when he entered the mobile home, he encountered an obstacle in the pathway between the living room and the south bedroom. He later identified it after the fire had been put out as a recliner chair that had been partially obstructing the doorway between the living room and the bedroom. Prosecutors also introduced evidence that Christine had told inconsistent stories. One of the neighbors who had been outside with Christine after the fire testified that Christine had told him that Tony was behind a locked door, even though the door between the living room and the bedroom had been removed sometime prior to the fire. And the manager of the mobile home park, a woman named Connie Land, testified that when Christine and her mom returned to the mobile home a few days after the fire to thank everybody who had helped, Christine said that somebody else had been in the trailer with her and Tony that night, and that that somebody else had sprinkled her with either kerosene or gasoline. The state also explained to the jury how Christine's injuries were minor and consistent with a brief but direct exposure to flame. And then the state presented the different accounts Christine had told them about the night itself. She had said that she and Tony had gone to sleep on the couch in the living room or in the bedroom. She had also varied on whether or not she saw smoke when she woke up and whether she saw flames in the bedroom doorway or on the floor by her bed. She also gave various accounts of seeing Tony and him speaking to her as she tried to put the fire out. Then it was the defense's turn. Christine's attorney, Frank Hamilton, called a private fire investigator named Tom Hulse to the stand. Hulse said that he disagreed with the fire marshal's conclusion that the fire had been arson, and he said that in his opinion, it could have been electrical. He said there was evidence of past electrical problems in the home, and therefore it should have been classified as undetermined and not arson. Relatives and friends testified about the relationship between Christine and her son. According to one friend, their relationship couldn't have been any better. He worshipped her and she worshipped him. Another friend took the stand to refute a possible motive that had been put forth by investigators. They had claimed that a week after the fire, this friend had told them that Christine had asked her to take custody of Tony a year prior to this happening. But the friend told the jury that it wasn't true and that she hadn't said half of those things. She clarified that one of the officers told her that he heard a rumor that Christine had offered to give her custody of Tony, but she told him that it wasn't true. She said what had happened was that Christine had been going through a rough time and that she had asked her that if anything happened to her, would she and her husband take care of her child? The friend said she told the officer that Christine was a good mother and that she was very loving and attentive towards her son. Christine's mother also refuted some of the testimony put forward by the state. She said that the chair that the firefighter Ron Clark had said was obstructing the doorway to the boy's room had always been in that location, so as not to obstruct a nearby heating vent, and that the chair stuck out a little bit, but not really. She also addressed the mobile home manager's testimony about Christine having said that somebody else had been in the home with her and that had started the fire. Christine's mom said that she had been there with Christine that day and that Christine had never said that to the manager. She also said that following the fire, she and the manager were engaged in litigation and that there were hard feelings between the parties, implying that the manager's testimony wasn't credible. Christine didn't testify in her defense, and she would later tell reporters that her attorney encouraged her to not show any emotion during the trial. As a result, she said she may have appeared unresponsive and sullen, and that she never spoke or cried during the testimony. In his closing arguments, Prosecutor Smith condemned Christine for not trying to save Tony and for not expressing enough remorse in her interviews with police. He said that Christine had wanted to give up her son, even though that friend had denied it under oath. The trial lasted for 6 days. The jury deliberated for several hours before they delivered their verdict. They found Christine guilty of both felony murder and arson. And remember, at this point, Christine was 5 months pregnant, something Judge Westhaver definitely noticed and addressed as he sentenced her. He said, "I understand you have arranged to have yourself impregnated during the period of time that you were out of jail and prior to your trial. I can think of no other reason for that to have happened than that you thought it would work to your advantage somehow in this process. It will not." He then told her that he would see to it that her baby would become a ward of the state and put up for adoption. "You will not raise that child," he said. "You'll have nothing to do with that child." Christine was then ordered to serve a 50-year sentence for the arson, concurrently with 60 years for the felony murder conviction. With good behavior, she could be eligible for parole in 30 years. When the guilty verdict was read, what was going through your mind?
Well, I was sentenced to 60 years for murder and 50 for arson. And I didn't hear the part where he said they were to be served concurrently, which meant that they were merged. In my mind, I'd just been sentenced to 110 years and I was going to die in there. And I was 5 months pregnant with my second child. So I'm wondering if I'm ever going to see him. What is the best thing to do for him?
Three months later, Christine gave birth to her baby while incarcerated. She had a C-section while being chained to a hospital bed. She gave birth to a healthy baby boy named Trent, and she was able to hold him briefly before returning to the Indiana Women's Prison the next day. Christine's parents got custody of Trent, and even though the judge had told her that she wouldn't be a part of his life, her parents took him to see her often.
After I had him, my family took him. I was blessed. I got to see him every week, every other week, depending on schedules and, you know, who could afford to drive him and bring him. He was 6 months old when the facility that I was in opened up a family preservation program. So I got to see him 2 hours each week on my own inside the facility. And that was nice. I had a room with carpeting and a couch and TV and toys, and I could just play with him and not think about where we were.
Meanwhile, Christine's appeal was going through the system. Her team was challenging a jury instruction that said that the state wasn't required to prove a motive to the sufficiency of the evidence and to the reasonableness of her sentence. The court ruled against her, and they ruled that there was sufficient evidence to support the felony murder conviction. Her conviction and the 60-year sentence was affirmed. It's hard to imagine the feelings you'd have as you sit there in your jail cell, day after day, wanting to scream from the rooftops that you're innocent, and knowing what an uphill battle you have in front of you, if you even have a battle at all. And it certainly might change your opinion on our justice system, and maybe even change your opinion on law enforcement in general.
I mean, I grew up and I think I was told everything that you hear in most families, that, you know, the police are there to protect you and tell the truth and everything will be all right. And I mean, I received a warning ticket for going 5 miles over the speed limit. That was the only interaction I'd ever had with the law.
But as difficult as her situation was, Christine didn't give up. She reached out to numerous attorneys and received just as many rejections. But one day in 2003, her luck would change. After your appeal was denied, I know there was a process where you began reaching out to attorneys pretty much by yourself to handle your post-conviction relief petition. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I sent out hundreds of letters, and many of them were never answered. The ones that were, they wanted huge amounts of money. There was no way I could afford $25,000 up front, and then more if we went back to trial. And I wrote all the innocence projects that I could get addresses for. I actually wrote Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions and received letters stating that they didn't have the resources or the staff to take on a case like mine. Eventually, I befriended a girl in the facility, and she was pregnant when she came in, and she lived next door to me. So I would bring her back cookies and different little things. And she suggested that I write to an attorney that she knew. And so I sent a letter to Hillary Borix, and she told me that she believed me. And she was the first person that told me that. And she said, I don't know how we're going to fight this, but we'll try. So we worked it out, and I got her the money, and every month I sent out my state pay to help pay for her.
In 2006, Christine and her new team filed a petition seeking a new trial under post-conviction relief. And in 2007, Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions finally got involved with Christine's case.
The Innocence Project got involved when one of the volunteers that came inside the prison with prison ministry, her name was Betsy, she became aware of my story through the chaplain, and I actually worked with the chaplain. It was one of my jobs. I usually had two or three jobs the entire time I was in. And she started talking to me, and then she did some research and sent paperwork and letters to the Center on Wrongful Conviction. She kept calling and made sure it was placed in Jane Raley's hands. And I think she got a call right after I did that they were going to step in and help. And that was the end of 2006, first part of 2007.
And 2 years after that, there was a pretty big development. One of Christine's new attorneys paid her a visit at the Indiana Women's Prison with a proposal of sorts. The Decatur County prosecutor had made an offer. They would dramatically reduce her sentence if she confessed to intentionally setting the fire that killed her son. And if she did, she could go home in 6 years.
That was the hardest decision that I've ever had to make. I mean, your lawyer, when they get an offer like that, they have to bring it to you. So when my lawyer from the center, Jane Raley, brought me the offer, my first thought was she doesn't believe in the case. We're going to lose. And that's why she's telling me this. And so I kept asking her, what do I do? What do I do? Because I wanted out more than anything. I wanted to be with my kid. I wanted to see my family. I was tired of watching everything from afar. And every time he come in, he was bigger and he could do more. Or somebody had taken him to do something that I wanted to do. So I struggled with it and I cried a lot during that visit. But ultimately, it was my son. I couldn't teach him that it's right to tell a lie to get what you want. And no matter how bad I wanted out, I wasn't going to admit to something I didn't do just to get that.
In a decision that might just be surprising to some, Christine decided not to take the deal. I'm going to end part one here. In part two, you'll hear about new evidence that just might change everything you think you know about this case. A special thank you to Christine Bunch for speaking with me. And thanks, as always, to all of you for your support. I also want to say a special thank you to my Patreon supporters. I'm going to name all of you in the next few episodes. But for today, this thank you goes to Becca, Tammy, Laura, Karen, and Emma. I really appreciate you, and I promise I will continue putting out content that you enjoy. If you'd like to donate as little as a dollar a month, please go to courtjunkie.com/support, and you can sign up as a Patreon supporter. You'll get early access to my Court Junkie briefs, as well as early access to some regular episodes. I'll also be adding some more perks there in the near future. That's courtjunkie.com/support. And don't forget to subscribe and leave me a review if you like the show. Thank you, and until next time.